Thursday, partly sunny with a high near 40. Thursday night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. The outlook for Friday, mostly sunny with a high in the low 50s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-40s to the mid-50s. Chicago's O'Hare Airport reported 44 degrees. It was 48 at Bloomington, 49 at Springfield. In Mattoon, 45. In Carbondale, 55. South Bend reported 44 degrees. It was 52 at Lafayette and 50 degrees at both Indianapolis and Terre Haute. At Willard Airport at the top of the hour, 47 degrees. The sky, cloudy. The dew point, 37. The wind out of the east at 15 miles per hour. The relative humidity, 68%. The barometric pressure, 30.14 and falling. And on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana, 48 degrees and cloudy. The 1970s saw the federal order desegregation of schools in Springfield, Illinois. That court ruling remains in place today. At the time it was handed down, opponents were upset at having their children bused to schools outside their immediate neighborhood. However, there was hope the integrated schools would improve student achievement for all students. In the second of a two-part series, Illinois Public Radio's Jenna Dooley looks at the impact of desegregation in Springfield's public schools.
Former Springfield School Board President Cheryl Wise learned the hard way how deep race runs through the city. Wise says she is still accused of being a racist after she tried to revisit the desegregation policy in 2004.
I do have battle scars, you know. I might have done it differently had I known than what I know now. I probably would have done it differently. Here, I just thought I could help change things for the better and just bring up an idea and people would respond.
Wise drew the ire of many when she announced the desegregation order in place in the district since 1976 was not closing the achievement gap among black and white students. She suggested lifting the consent decree requiring desegregation could reduce busing and strengthen parental involvement, since parents would be closer to their child's school. There would also be financial considerations. Money would be saved by not busing as many students across town and keeping poverty grants in poorer areas instead of diluting them to neighborhoods where poverty is much less. But Wise's effort was blocked by fellow board members and the community.
I felt desperate. I felt kind of desperate at the time, like wondering how are we ever going to close this achievement gap? And having the financial background that I have, I think in terms of money, and I know that that's not always, that you shouldn't always consider that. But, you know, and I thought, wow, we're spending $10 million a year on busing. And gosh, if we could have half of that and put it into the classroom, what could we do with that? And how could we close the achievement gap with that kind of money? And that's what I was looking at and what I was considering.
In 2008, Wise's fears were given credence. A report conducted by the city of Springfield and the local chapter of the Urban League put in black and white the achievement gap between black and white. The study found divisions appeared as early as third grade and remained steady until the eighth grade. One example from the report showed 6% of African-American students were college-ready in math, compared to 36% for white students. Another aspect of desegregation that garners hushed tones is what's known as white flight, parents going as far as moving their families to other districts or parochial schools instead of sending their children to District 186. Chatham, Rochester, Pleasant Plains, mostly white schools with mostly white teachers and high student performance to prepare them for college. A similar pattern is also seen within the school district. Of 700 whites who transferred from one school to another over a study of 4 years, about 80% transferred into Springfield High School from Lanphier and Southeast. This led to District 186 limiting student transfers starting last year. A federal judge threw out Chicago's desegregation order in 2009, 29 years after a federal lawsuit alleging the district discriminated against black and Hispanic students. In lifting the order, it was found strides had been made. If the nation's third largest school district rose above the challenges, many question if the time is ripe for Springfield to do the same. District 186 Superintendent Walter Milton, who is African American, downplays the role of desegregating students to achieve academic success.
I think that it does us a disservice that we have to say, in order to get this right or have a certain kind of balance, we have to follow this this order to the T. I think that, and I've been in conversation with our attorney to really just see how necessary it is at this juncture. I think looking at it from a conceptual standpoint, somewhat problematic, as well as potentially looking at it from a philosophical standpoint. I think that our country has to focus on other things like globalization. And in 2011, we're talking about a DSEG order. That is totally outside the scope of my educational agenda as superintendent of Springfield Public Schools.
But others say it doesn't hurt to have the order remain in place. Former Springfield Superintendent Don Miedema oversaw the change in the 1970s. He sees no reason to go back.
I don't sense any groundswell whatsoever to try to turn things around. I think people feel things are working about as well as they can under the circumstances, and I don't feel that there's any groundswell to try to change that.
A group of professors at what was then Sangamon State University helped push for the desegregation order. Now retired, Professor Larry Golden says the school district hasn't handled race perfectly, but the desegregation order is better left in place.
We would not have the number of black teachers we have now, the number of black administrators that exist now. We wouldn't have students who are going through school on a more racially integrated basis if the order had never been there. So having the order there is sort of, to me, like a reminder that you do have this other responsibility.
Add Teresa Haley to the chorus in favor of keeping the order in place. Haley is a former student and president of the Springfield chapter of the NAACP. She says Springfield still lacks a proportional number of minority teachers, but wholesale change isn't the answer.
I think bringing up the discussion is almost like beating a dead horse. If it's something that's working and we've adjusted to it and we're continuing to make improvements under it, then we need to continue to do it. Because I think if you drop it and let it go, people tend to go back to their old ways. So I think if they think someone's continuing to watch them and monitor what's happening, they're going to stay on their P's and Q's.
Still, it's clear Springfield District 186 has its share of problems, like many larger school systems. But the argument continues over whether or not desegregation has accomplished its goal of offering all students more opportunity. Test scores show the achievement gap between black and white students remains. But until Springfield is ready to further tackle the issue of race and equity, the topic will remain below the surface, where it's been since the desegregation order took effect in the 1970s. I'm Jenna Dooley.
It's 12:45. This is the Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media. China's leaders want to put the brakes on their superheated economy. NPR's Louisa Lim reports that could be difficult.
With fanfare, China's next five-year plan was unveiled as Parliament opened this weekend. The local media seems to have taken away one main point, summed up in this magazine headline: Goodbye GDP Worship. China's government's new economic growth target is 7% a year, way down from the past five sizzling years, which averaged 11.2% annual growth. Senior economic planner Zhang Ping summed it up. It's no longer about growth at all costs, but better growth, more money in people's pockets, and a move away from exports towards growth driven by domestic consumption. Making this happen could be hard because of conflicting goals. China Merchants Bank chairman Ma Weihua spelled out his doubts to NPR.
Local governments want fast development to increase their revenues and improve people's lives. But nationally, over-fast development could harm stable development and increase inflation.
In fact, 25 out of 31 of China's provinces have set double-digit economic growth targets for the next 5 years. Of the delegates at the conference, few want slower growth in their own backyards. Chen Xitao from Anhui Province is typical.
The report just states a goal. I should say that our province is less developed. Our growth will definitely be faster than 7%.
There are other problems too. Rising incomes could lead to more inflation, which directly contradicts another policy aim of beating inflation. And slowing growth threatens vested interests. China's state-run media says these new targets could challenge officials and even test their ability to govern. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Have Muslims in America been radicalized? That's what a congressional committee will ask this week. Some think it's long overdue. Others say the hearing unfairly singles out one religious group.
That's the kind of thing that leads you to the Salem witch trials, the Inquisition, and frankly, McCarthyistic hearings.
Investigating who's responsible for homegrown terrorism today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Recently, the House of Representatives passed H.R. 1, the continuing resolution, which eliminates federal funding for public broadcasting. Now the Senate will draft its version. It makes a difference when your senators hear from you that funding for public broadcasting is important. Contact information is at will.illinois.edu. Stay informed at 170millionamericans.org. Thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 8th of March, 2011. It's the birthday of the man who, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, was the first to describe a piece of literature as postmodernist. That was Leslie Fiedler, born in Newark, 1917, best known for his book Love and Death in the American Novel, in which he said he believed that the great theme of American literature is the search for identity. He said Americans have no real identity. We're all uprooted people who come from elsewhere. He was one of the first American critics to argue in favor of popular culture and genre fiction. He once said the only writer of the late 20th century who would be remembered was Stephen King. It's the birthday of Kenneth Graham, born Edinburgh, 1859, best known for his book The Wind in the Willows. The book was a big success. He was able to retire from his bank job. He lived for another 25 years, but he never wrote another one. It's the birthday of John McPhee, born Princeton, New Jersey, 1931, author of more than 30 books, many articles for The New Yorker magazine. Most recent collection is Silk Parachute. It came out last March. It's the birthday of the novelist Jeffrey